This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The North Carolina primary is over, so what's next in the race for the White House, the governor's mansion, and North Carolina's U.S. Senate seat? President Obama has decided to play a game of chicken with the Senate by nominating a candidate for the Supreme Court. We look at the impact that might have on the North Carolina Senate race. Charlotte City Manager Ron Carley decides to move on, but City Council extends his contract, gives him a raise, and a $25,000 bonus. And police body cams are back in the news. This time, CMPD is refusing to release footage, raising questions about possible excessive force and a lack of transparency. Those and other stories will be the focus of our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Nick Oxner, an investigative reporter for WBTV News. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey.
We're also joined by Eric with a K, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric with a C, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for being here as well. Good morning.
Morning.
Hillary Clinton was the star of the night in North Carolina last Tuesday night. Hers was the first race to be called. Was this the Obama effect?
I think this was the history of the Clintons with African-American voters effect. And I was at the rally Monday night and talked to a number of African-American voters, and it was just as so many people have talked about. I mean, the loyalty is unyielding, and it wasn't so much that these voters didn't like Bernie Sanders. It was that they thought Hillary Clinton could deliver. They liked the pragmatism and the history of Hillary Clinton's political career.
And this finishes her what they really called the Southern sweep for Hillary Clinton, which is, if you look at the map, you know, literally from Virginia all the way on down, including Florida, and then all over to Texas, she just cleaned the Bernie Sanders clock in the South because simply of the African-American vote. You cannot underestimate that vote. It is so important to Democrats because in primaries, it is the core of their base. So if there was any chance that Bernie Sanders had in the South, we really knew that it was going to be, let's just say, a tough slog once Nevada came in. You remember that caucus right before, or actually during the same time as South Carolina? Hillary Clinton won that vote, the African-American vote in that state, I should say, by something like 80 points. And you saw that again in South Carolina. You saw that again all over the place. And that's including North Carolina.
And it's just such a huge missed opportunity for Bernie Sanders because, I mean, his policies and his platform, and under normal circumstances, would be very appealing to the African-American community. But he just did not have that sort of personal history and track record, especially with African Americans in the South,
and
they just didn't feel like they knew him.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because, you know, there is this love affair with Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton in particular, but then also with Hillary, and it does seem to ignore. And I was waiting to see if the Sanders camp would jump on this. You remember Bill Clinton's whole tough on crime bill
right,
and all that stuff? I mean, if you look at that, it is the seed of what both Democratic presidential candidates call the incredible mass incarceration rate. Yeah. It was started by Bill Clinton.
And see, I think Bill Clinton diffused that, and apparently pretty effectively, by saying, I was wrong, I shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. I guess it was last summer he started making those statements. And apparently that resonated. That was enough for African-American voters. The other thing that strikes me about all of this, of course, is that Hillary has this huge sweep in the South, and when we get to the general election, the South will not be her friend.
No.
And how much of this also has to do with the fact that she is campaigning on a third Obama term?
That's a part of it, sure. I mean, there is.
And that she maybe she's the one that can beat Donald Trump and not Bernie Sanders.
Well, that's by polls, that's not exactly true.
Okay, I'm just asking.
No, the ironic thing is my job.
But you're right, Tom. Most of the polls have shown that Bernie would do better in a head-to-head with Donald Trump. But I think what you're getting at, Mike, is correct, which is, you know, Hillary not only has that history but was Secretary of State, obviously, under Barack Obama. And I did have people telling me Monday that this is the best person to carry forward what's been started.
Yeah, they feel like she was loyal to Obama and kind of waited her turn after he sort of unceremoniously jumped in front of her in 2008 and 12.
Yeah, when you consider that this was a group of voters that in the 08 primary just – unexpectedly went to Barack Obama, and Hillary, I think, really counted on getting that vote in 08, and it's almost, you know, now maybe she just thought it was her turn because of, you know, this mass, you know, flip-flop in 08. So it's interesting.
Well, Clinton beat Sanders by a slimmer margin than expected, I think, only 14 points, but with 81% of the African-American vote, while Trump edged past Cruz by less than 4 points here in North Carolina. WFAE reported, Tom, that exit polls in that race identified "shares my values" as the single biggest reason North Carolinians voted for a candidate. Is this a change that more people here would share the values of Donald Trump than of Ted Cruz, who's an evangelical type of candidate?
If you look just at the broad buckets of Republican voters, it seems that way. But this year in particular, it's far more important to really get down in like the substrata of these exit polls and see how people are thinking. Because if you follow on "shares my values," now officially Ted Cruz won that broad bucket, but you break it down further and it's do I feel betrayed by my party? I'm angry, basically, is another one. I want somebody who is there for change. Donald Trump swept all of those subgroups, which is what really pushed him over the top. But what was interesting to me about this race is, just like Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump was expected to take this state pretty handily.
Yeah, he was what, 14-point advantage, and he won by four. I think Hillary was 24 points, and she won by what, 13?
14.
So, yeah, the polls were a little bit off on both of those races in North Carolina.
And it also just starts showing kind of this coalescing of, you know, by the time North Carolina rolled around, Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, was more or less a zombie candidate. I mean, he really needed to win Florida just to justify continuing another day. John Kasich never made a presence in North Carolina. He stayed in Ohio.
Right.
So basically, you had this kind of coalescing around Ted Cruz for people who either loved Ted Cruz on
his own. He was here a lot.
Oh, and he was also here a lot. You're absolutely right. But either people who loved Ted Cruz on his own, or people who just didn't like Donald Trump.
Have we seen the last of the presidential candidates in North Carolina, or will
no,
they be back
so.
Before the general
election? No, I don't think so, because we're a purple state, as everyone likes to say. And so I would think we're going to see both the nominees a fair amount in the fall.
Look at it this way. North Carolina is a purple state, but more importantly, if you stick it to just red and blue states, it's difficult to find a path for a Republican nominee to make it to the required number of electoral votes to become president without winning North Carolina. It is that key. So even if, let's say that it's far more of a reddish state towards the general election, all the Democrats really have to do is make a few trips down, spend a whole lot of money, and North Carolina can turn into a sinkhole for Republican time and money, which allows them to focus.
Puts that pressure on the Republican nominee, absolutely.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did Charlotte not pitch for this year's Republican National Convention?
Charlotte thought about it, ultimately decided not to, and the thinking seems to be 2020 or 2024. I think people
– Did we dodge the bullet?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Nobody
Maybe
realized
literally.
It at that time. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Be careful. Hello, Cleveland. Yeah.
All right.
In a word, yes.
In the race for governor, incumbent Republican Pat McCrory won the GOP primary, and Democratic challenger Attorney General Roy Cooper the Democratic primary. What role, if any, did anger over the I-77 toll lanes play in all of this?
Seems to be pretty you feel a lot.
Well, in northern Mecklenburg and southern Iredell County, obviously not across the state, in northern Mecklenburg and Iredell County, the numbers on that are, and I don't have them, but I think Tom does, written down in front of him, are really fascinating when you see just how few people voted for Pat McCrory, who you would, you know, in basically his own backyard over – you know, in the primary.
And the reason this matters, of course, is because this is expected to be one of the most closely contested governor's races in the country. So, of course, every vote starts to matter. And when you get into I-77, which shows no signs of being resolved anytime soon to the satisfaction of consensus, then we can just carry this on into November.
You've got numbers. Republicans who are saying up in that area who are saying they'll actually vote for the Democrat.
Well, and let's look. But
certainly may not vote.
Yeah, they'll stay home.
Or they'll skip that slot.
And
on the
look
ballot.
At Charles Jeter. Look at Charles Jeter. Absolutely. That's a great example of what's going on. Yeah. It was a 28-vote margin, and he's a guy who opposed this thing and has been fighting it publicly. But before he opposed it,
he came to the table
and opposed it earlier.
Absolutely,
enough.
And that's what I'm saying. That's the whole point is, so look at what his stance has done, how it's changed, and he still just very narrowly got through.
It was, 7,500 votes he defeated, or at least so far. There'll be a recount, obviously. Yeah. But he's leading Tom Davis by 28
votes. I thought it was 23. Yeah, nothing, right? Yeah. And I think there's still a sense up there that even though now Jeter's come to the table and tried to do a tap dance around his old positions, that the voters up there still think that, you know, secretly he still supports the tolls. And I think he was smart to realize, take a look at what happened in the municipal elections last year and say, oh, crap, maybe I should.
Yeah,
I should.
But my point is, though, if he has gone to that much effort to flip his position, Governor McCrory, by comparison, is thought by opponents of the toll lane to have done really nothing for them.
And there's going to be a recount in that race.
Yes,
is that correct? How long will that take?
As long as it takes. Yes. Let me put some numbers actually to show that how this difference with the Pat McCrory race really played out in what is not just a key voting block area for the Republicans, but also one of their big fundraising areas. Statewide, Pat McCrory won by 82%, or won 82% of the vote. I'm sorry, he won by 71%. In Mecklenburg, overall, he got 78% of the vote. In in Iredale County, and again, Southern Iredale is where I-77 is also a huge issue, he only got 56% of the vote. So you can see in the real hotbed areas, and right there around the area of Lake Norman, you know, the precincts of Pat McCrory won, he often won by single digits or flat out lost. I mean, you can see exactly where that
anger is. I don't think there's anything he can really do in a practical sense about that for the general election. He's just
canceled the contract.
He's just
stuck. There you go.
But he's not going to do
well,
that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
Robert Brawley, who was one of Governor McCrory's two challenges in the primary and essentially ran because of his opposition to the toll lane, said afterward that he believes the Department of Transportation's plans for tolls elsewhere in the state, because I'm told that from now on all major road projects will be toll projects, will bring more trouble to the governor. He said, I think if they don't pay attention to what happened in the Lake Norman area and they try to toll all of the state of North Carolina, they're going to find a revolt in North Carolina.
And the next big one in our area is in another Republican stronghold, which is South Charlotte.
Right. If you look at Charles Jeter's district, it runs from northern Mecklenburg and down the western border and into Steel Creek and southern parts of Mecklenburg, where he won. And I think that's the reason that he was able to fend off at least
the southern part, right?
Right. But it's interesting because those people, the folks in the southern part of the county, give it 5 years and they're going to be just as angry at tolls as the folks in Mecklenburg, in northern Mecklenburg County. And so 485 is coming.
And again, we talked about this last week. I mean, so much of this boils down to a lack of political will to find a way to pay for roads other than tolls, which is an easy way of saying, hey, look, I'm not raising your taxes. It's a user tax. User fee. I'm sorry. We wouldn't use the word tax. That would be wrong.
At the very least, the Department of Transportation is going to have to figure out how to sell these projects better to the general public, or else they're going to just have to break this mold that they've come up with, in that, i.e., that tolls are the way to build big projects and come up with something different.
I wonder if they can. I mean, it's a really good point that you bring up, but I wonder if it is too late, because the public opinion is so solidified one way or the other on these roads, it may be too late for a rebranding campaign.
It may be.
But, you know, if politicians start losing elections, they'll change their mind really quickly on things like that. We're talking about the political
outcome of the
primary.
It's called evolving, Mike.
Well, yes. My thinking on that has evolved.
Yes.
My thinking on this has not changed. We must take a break. I can't evolve on that. We'll come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Clayworks, a Charlotte home for ceramic arts and artists, now registering for spring adult classes and children's summer camps. Details at learnclay.com. Concerns about violence on television began almost as soon as television did. Medical experts have long said that children pick up on the violent behavior they see on the screen, and they can take that make-believe violence and turn it into real-life aggression. But violence on TV doesn't just occur in dramas. Have you watched the news lately? Think about San Bernardino. Think about Paris. Well, that has an effect, too, and some experts who have researched the real-world effects of media violence share what they've learned about all this with us on this program, Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama names a Supreme Court nominee, Donald Trump warns of riots if Republicans try to block his nomination, and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder testifies on Capitol Hill about the Flint water crisis.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after the Charlotte Talks News Roundup here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly local news roundup with WFAE's Tom Bullock. Nick Ochsner is here. He's an investigative reporter with WBTV News. Eric C. Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric E. Spanberg, B-E-R-G, with the Charlotte Business Journal. As we go through this hour, you're welcome to comment or ask your own questions at charlottetalks@wfae.org or at WFAE on Facebook or Charlotte Talks on Twitter. And Peggy emails, where does exit polling take place? In my 30-plus years voting, I have never seen an exit poll taker. Neither have I, by the way. Also, may I recommend Nate Silver's 538 election podcast? Mm-hmm. No, Peggy, you may not.
You only not can alone. Listen it's to the terrestrial radio.
It's an awesome it's podcast.
It is an awesome podcast. So, where do these exit polls take place?
Outside of polling stations, as funny as it sounds.
Who does it?
Actually, Nate Silver does them all.
No. The exit poll, it's a great question she brings up. I was actually asked once as part of an exit poll. Ironically, was when I lived in Washington, D.C., so literally I had but one vote and nothing when it came to, you know, U.S. Senate or Congress. But there's a couple of firms. I think there are two firms out there that send people with clipboards to stand outside of exit polls and ask people if they're willing to answer questions. And it is turned into kind of a, you know, a media stalwart of trying to figure out exactly what's about to happen. And what's really interesting to me, though, is they'll release early exit polls and then full exit polls. A lot of early exit polls are actually done by news organizations. Like CNN will do their own. But then you'll find some where they have crossover questions. So, you know, maybe they just actually paid the same firm to get, you know, them to ask the questions. And then they get rights to it first.
So if you wanted to be interviewed for as part of an exit poll, where should you vote?
Poll? Probably in the swing you
know,
district.
They do it for
generally.
Every contest. I don't. That's a great question. I don't know.
They probably pick the swing precincts. The precincts that are sort of the
right.
Bellwethers.
Yeah.
That's just my guess.
Successor to the Pepsi Challenge.
So our governor's race going forward is going to be, I'm told, the most competitive and most expensive in the country.
Just look at your email inbox already.
Yes.
I have nothing about this in my email box.
No one has alerted nothing. Mike that there's a governor's race going on.
No.
Well, let's say it this way then. From the same group that brought you Tillis Hagen, now we give you Cooper McCrory. Prepare to have your football games interrupted by a lot of ads.
And prior to the primary, Roy Cooper had $5.7 million in his campaign war chest, while the governor reported $4.3 million. What does the difference in that amount tell us, if anything?
Well, if you're a Democrat, it tells you that Roy Cooper is bound for the governor's mansion. And if you're a Republican, it just tells you that, you know, Roy Cooper is just taking all this money from people who shouldn't be giving money to Roy Cooper.
Or so. If you're an incumbent, you don't need as much money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah.
They didn't need to spend anything in these primaries.
Right.
And they didn't. And Roy Cooper has surprisingly, outraised Pat McCrory.
Although I think what McCrory would say, though, of course, is that his name recognition and his support is already so much greater than Cooper's that this is
and that's
you know,
a
not
fair
a problem.
Point.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it may not always be a good thing, though.
Name recognition cuts both ways.
Yeah, I also think that number's a little deceptive because McCrory has spent all of his time campaigning and raising money for the Connect NC Bond Initiative and campaigning or educating, whichever words we want to use, about the bond, which is in effect been, you know, hasn't required any of his campaign money, but has put him out here just as much as if he were campaigning for governor. Yeah, so that's so far given him a big advantage.
And that's been interesting with the bonds because post-election, he now looks like he's going to run as the guy who passed the bonds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know? Yes.
And before, it was there was this issue about him not tying his own campaign too closely to the bonds.
So it's almost like he's going to try and make himself into the education governor between bonds and the teacher pay raises, although they were scant from a couple years ago.
And he did try to make himself the transportation governor as well, because let's not forget the fact that it's called the Connect NC Bond, because originally he proposed adding an additional $1 billion for road projects, which was unceremoniously stripped out by the North Carolina Senate.
Right.
Well, speaking of the bonds, Nick Auctioner did a whole thing on WBTV, an investigative report on this, and evidently perhaps the governor is not the person responsible for the passage of the bonds. Perhaps it's the people who will benefit from the bonds themselves.
yes, that is probably pretty fair. Yeah, our report last night found that and so the Connect NC committee is a political committee that was formed to promote the bonds and advocating and urging people to vote yes. And so they raised roughly $2 million. And of that $2 million, more than a quarter of that money came from public universities in North Carolina and public community colleges and their institutional and, in the case of some community colleges, federal funds. And that may be illegal. State law says that public resources cannot be used to expressly advocate for or against a thing. Mm-hmm. And so we went out and asked we asked the governor. We asked Margaret Spellings, the new president of the UNC system. We asked former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr, the spokesman for the Connect NC Bond Committee, is this illegal? And they all say no. The governor says he wasn't advocating. The UNC system said, no, we can use this money. And Bob Orr said, you should ask all the people who gave us money. I think we've now raised some questions that I think hopefully some folks will take a harder look at.
So would it be against federal or state law if it were illegal?
State law definitely says that you can't use public money or resources. So the governor traveling around the state with the state resources also could potentially be a violation of the law if he said, we need you to vote for the bond. And we actually have a couple video clips. We didn't put it in our story last night, but we have a couple video clips where he actually did say, I need you to vote yes for the bond. Also, his campaign on Tuesday morning said he had traveled around the state making the case for the bond.
So had she advocated for the bonds, had Margaret Spellings advocated for the bonds when she was on this program on Tuesday, which she did not, but had she done so, would she be in violation?
Potentially, yes. And it's interesting, the UNC system spokeswoman told me that the UNC Board of Governors officially endorsed the bond. And I have this in an email. I think it's in our web story. Officially endorsed the bond. And so they think, because the Board of Governors took a position that the bond was good for the UNC system, Spellings was authorized to express support and urge people to vote for the bond. Now, that's in conflict with how I read the state law, but they believe that they weren't violating.
Well, now, with the governor, we get into this every incumbent presidential election. I mean, there are so many reasons for a trip. It seems like it's easy to say, look, he was going here to do something else, and he mentioned it in passing. I'm not defending. I'm just asking. The other thing I wonder about is colleges always have and do lobby and employ lobbyists. So, you know, what is the difference there?
I think they may have, and I'm not positive.
I'm asking.
This,
I have no idea.
But I think in a lot of these cases, these schools have different pots of money,
some of which are
raised privately. And I bet that's probably going to be their defense.
So
probably.
Years ago, when CMS was going to be the beneficiary of local school bonds, they asked me to come and moderate a program on CMS television for the bonds, which I would not do because I can't advocate for the bonds. But nonetheless, they did a program on it. Would that be also under the same category?
Potentially, yeah. And it matters on where the money comes from. But what this boils down to, and I believe
they can't advocate for their own benefit?
No. Not with public money. With that's public the key. Money. It's where the money source came from.
Which is usually why they turn to the Charlotte Chamber or somebody.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Now, this gets into the wonderful, lovely, murky world of lack of definitions in campaign finance and electioneering ruling. It all comes down to what's known as direct advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed if you have clips of Pat McCrory actually saying, we need you to vote for the bond. That is a pretty clear violation, because what you are allowed to do is to educate, which means you can advocate for an issue. But when the second that you say the word vote, either for or against, that becomes a clear moment of electioneering. And that is an absolute fact under North Carolina law and federal law. I obviously haven't seen that footage, but that right there, the minute you move to a direct call for action, yeah, specifically including the word vote, it's not murky anymore.
To wrap up our conversation about the governor's race between Pat McCrory and Roy Cooper, how much of their fate rests on the ultimate decision of the national parties on who their candidates will be?
There we go.
That's a fun question.
I think Pat McCrory has got to be extremely nervous.
Yes.
Insert whatever adjective you want right there. With
Donald
the
Trump
prospect
is
of
not
Donald
help
Trump
for him,
at the top.
I don't think.
Yeah, and you don't know what Donald Trump will do between now and November. And what if he does something really, you know, goes off the rails, he takes Pat McCrory with him.
There are three choices that every major politician will make between now and, you know, the general election. When it comes to specifically Donald Trump, you either say, I'm for Donald Trump, you say, I'm actively campaigning against Donald Trump getting the nomination, or you say, I will support our party's candidate, which
what if there's
allows
a third
you wiggle.
Party? Mm-hmm.
Then they're no longer your party's candidate, is
it? Well, what if the Republicans float another candidate and Donald Trump becomes the third party?
That gets into far more tricky situations there, because you're still going to run. Do you remember when the Soviet Union broke up,
mm-hmm,
and they still had the Olympics, and you had all of these former Soviet Union Olympians who didn't yet have formally recognized nations marching under the Olympic flag as
right.
their banner?
Yes.
Well, think of that in terms of politics. It sounds crazy, but it's true. There isn't enough time for a full-on third party to get created on a state level. Pat McCrory will still be a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these other people will remain Republicans. It's easier to do that on a national level than it is to build the infrastructure on a local level.
So we have a lot of things to cover here. So let's move on to the Senate race, because incumbent Republican Senator Richard Burr easily won his primary, defeating challenger Greg Brannon by more than 350,000 votes. But Burr neither gave a victory speech, nor did he put out a press release, a statement. That strike you as odd?
Well, he actually spent the day in D.C. testifying before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and chairing a House Intel Committee meeting instead
hard,
of
hard
North
at work.
Carolina.
Hard at work.
You know, at least that was the appearance that he
yeah.
gave. And you talk about a race that I don't think will be impacted greatly by Donald Trump or anyone being on the top of the ticket. I think that Senator Burr, look, has a lot of money in his war chest. A lot of, you know, where we talked about McCrory lagging behind Roy Cooper in fundraising, Richard Burr has the opposite problem. He has north of $5 million in the bank. You know,
he'd have to have an Elizabeth Dole moment.
Yeah.
So is this race between him and Deborah Ross, the Democratic winner, over before it starts?
No. I'm going to say no. And I will say this. I was really watching the Burr primary. I'm not surprised at all that he won. But as I said at our Charlotte Talks on Monday that was previewing the primary, what was interesting to me is, you know, I love the fact that Burr was actually, you know, being a politician and doing his job on primary day. That's fantastic. He is an establishment, potentially seen as an establishment guy, and he has two main problems going for him. Number one, if it really is a big Donald Trump wave, being an established Republican in the Senate, can help or hurt. And I'm not sure what the answer is there. But number two, if it's a Ted Cruz presidency or Ted Cruz candidacy, let's not forget that Richard Burr is the one who directly on the Senate floor called Ted Cruz's move to try to shut down the federal government the stupidest idea he had ever heard. Those are his words.
He's not alone in saying that.
No, he's not. But the fact that he threw it out there puts him, you know, he's got a pretty strong flag planted exactly yeah. where he stands on that issue and that candidate. Now, the trickier thing is the Supreme Court.
Well, you yeah. wanted to talk about yeah. Merrick Garland, and
well,
now it's your chance because he's a Republican and the Republicans are refusing to hold
he's
hearings
a Democrat.
At the moment.
He's actually a Democrat.
No, I'm talking about Richard Burr.
Oh, no, he is a Republican.
Yeah.
Yes, he is still a Republican. Well, real quickly, though, as you're talking about that with the Senate race and Donald Trump, let's look at the primaries. I mean, a lot of people thought that incumbents on the Republican side would be thrown out as part of the sentiment in these states where Trump is winning so by such a large margin, and that has not happened.
Nope.
So maybe that does not impact Richard Burr.
The reason I brought up David Merrick, he's a producer, Merrick Garland, the reason I brought him up is because you have the situation now where the Republicans are the majority of Republicans saying no hearings, but
and
some
North
Republicans
Carolina's
are
too. Yes.
And some Republicans are going to have some behind-the-scenes meetings, maybe. But will this impact, if the majority of Americans think that the Senate ought to hold hearings on the nominee and they don't, will that impact the Senate race?
It really has the potential to, and I think that's exactly what the Democrats are hoping for in their choice of Judge Garland. I mean, he is a centrist Democrat, widely praised. His nomination, you know, it's funny. Actually, Nina Totenberg was interviewing President Obama on Morning Edition this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, she really pushed him on a simple issue, which is you keep talking about how he may be one of the greatest minds of his generation. Why didn't you pick him prior?
Yeah.
And President Obama finally came out and was like, well, I really want him to be confirmed. And that tells you a lot. That's how centrist this candidate is. He is not a Sonia Sotomayor. He is not far to the left on the political spectrum. He is a nuts and bolts, heavy on the wonk side. Of a judge, and he is exactly the kind of guy that the Republicans would normally love to see from a Democrat.
Which is why you now see them saying that there are some senators who are saying that they would consider trying to ram him through in a lame duck session if Hillary Clinton wins, because they know the alternative would be much less appealing to them.
And going back to, you know, we're talking about coattails. It's interesting to me because it's easy to imagine the coattails, the down ballot drama of a Donald Trump candidacy. On the flip side of that, you also have a very motivated Republican base potentially waiting to come out if it is a Hillary Clinton presidency, which she is well on the way to.
But
she is just as polarizing to some.
This Republican stance provides another problem for the GOP, and it was highlighted yesterday in a Kevin Sayers cartoon on the editorial page. In the left panel, you have an elephant holding a newspaper with the Merrick nomination headline, and the elephant declaring, "Obama must be stopped. The people's voice must be heard." In the right panel, the elephant is holding a newspaper with the headline, "Trump." And the elephant is saying, "The people must be stopped."
I'm actually a little mad at Kevin because I wrote the editorial, our editorial on that this morning, and I was going to go there, and Kevin got there before me. I was like, "Dang it!"
I guess I would disagree with you a little bit on that point, Tom, about the polarization. Because look, Trump's nomination is possibly going to break up the party or at least rupture it. No one on the Democratic side is saying if Hillary is nominated, you know, the game's over.
That's not my point. The point isn't the Democrats. The point is the Republicans.
Trump's negatives are in the 60s. Hillary's negatives are in the 50s. Both of them are more disliked than they are liked. And so if you're the middle of the road person in America, are you going to go vote at all?
Right. It's always a turnout question, but this time with those levels of disapproval, it really becomes interesting whether people just stay home.
But getting back to your editorial and to Kevin's cartoon, do ordinary people see it the way he saw it in that cartoon?
I think maybe not right this moment, but I think as this continues to play out and as it continues to kind of settle in, that contradiction or that sort of lack of continuity there. It's pretty clear and pretty obvious. I mean, you can't say that you want the people to decide except when the people are deciding in a way you don't like.
This convention, the convention this summer is really shaping up to be quite the disaster if this push for a brokered candidate goes through. It's going to be a mess.
I hope if television is smart, they're raising the price of advertising right now.
Look out, C-SPAN.
We have to take a break. When we come back, Ron Carley gets a raise. Another one? Yes. Right after this, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, committed to providing collaborative legal solutions to the business community. Offices in Charlotte, Rock Hill, and the Research Triangle, robinsonbradshaw.com. Well, the weekly news roundup will continue in the next hour, the national hour on the Diane Rehm Show, with guest host Indira Lakshmanan. President Obama names a Supreme Court nominee. Donald Trump warns of riots if Republicans try to block his nomination. And Michigan Governor Rick Snyder testifies on Capitol Hill about the Flint water crisis. Those stories and more coming up. And then the International Hour follows at 11. If you'd like to comment on what we're talking about, you can reach us at CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org, through WFAE on Facebook, or Charlotte Talks on Twitter. We're coming right back.
This week on All Things Considered, the secrets to thriving in middle age.
Got my bicycle and dusted it off and oiled the chain and started riding. And I couldn't ride a quarter mile without getting off the bike and walking. That's how I started.
Finding new passions after 40, plus all the latest in politics this week and coverage from the campaign trail. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Join me for All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our local weekly news roundup in advance of Diane Reams' national and international hours coming up in 20 minutes. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Charlotte's highly experienced, pedigreed city manager, Ron Carley, announced a couple of weeks ago that he would not seek an extension of his contract. We've talked about this before. He seemed to have rubbed people the wrong way on city council by becoming the face of government, which is what he was asked to be. But this week, city council extended his contract for 3 months to keep him here through the budgeting process and gave him a raise and $25,000 bonus. Now, under his old contract, and I feel sorry for him because under his old contract, he would have made an additional $72,000 to stay on for 3 months. Wow. He'll make $112,810 now for working in April, May, and June, plus the bonus. And Mayor Roberts added that she thought he was underpaid.
Well, I would
What's going on here?
Well, let's say this. If he doesn't continue on in city government, he could be an agent.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's going on
The guy's
here?
Negotiation
yeah.
skills are
I mean,
right up there. Nothing wrong there.
I would love him to represent me and my family in any negotiation because apparently he's very, very good at it. I tell you the thing, other than the numbers that surprised me the most, is it's been pretty quiet. You know, there are a couple of council members didn't like it, but you really haven't. I would have thought this would be the kind of issue where people would go bananas.
But, I mean, do they want him to stay? He said he came to
them. They need him to stay.
They need him.
They don't want him to. They need him.
They need him on that wall, on that budget wall.
Here's the interesting thing. And, I mean, part of this to me, which I'm still trying to figure out which camp I fully is telling the closest thing to the truth on this one, either that he was not going to be extended, so he pulled out of his contract extension, or Ron Carley literally just said, thanks very much, have a nice day.
No, well, wait a minute. I mean, remember, he said last summer he wanted to stay. I think it was pretty clear he was not getting a contract.
Well, I think you're probably right. But here's the thing that's interesting. First of all, when he says he's going to step down, they have no immediate replacement, no interim city manager, no deputy manager that's asked to step into that void. And the timing is huge because one of the first things we notice is this was during right ahead of budget season. This is arguably the most important time for the city manager. So all of a sudden, you see this, you know, what is it, a 20% pay raise? You see all of this.
25%.
It just shows you that, okay, well then either the city should have coalesced around him and extended him because they don't have anyone else in the wings at all, or, you know, just wait. You know, I'm not even sure what the other side of that coin is.
Well, there are a couple of things going on here. I mean, the first is, remember, this is the first city manager
that had a
contract. Now, when he negotiated that contract,
everybody else was at will.
He never had a raise. Okay, he made this, and I know he makes a lot of money, but he made the same amount of money for 3 years, so he never had a raise. And then, as Tom was saying, he picked a very good time to go back and say, well, you know, I am stepping away, but if you need me to stay, there's a way I could.
Well, here's the other thing that went on when they voted on this on, I think it was Monday night. Mayor Roberts put this on the agenda, but she didn't put it on the public agenda, so no one knew it was coming. And the public couldn't
I'm sure that was accidental, Mike.
How unusual is that? And why would she have done that?
Well, I think that gets maybe to part of my point about people would have done some – they would have responded.
Well, she was asked why, and she said she can't comment because it's a personnel matter. How are agenda items a personnel matter?
Well, she's not parsing the language right there.
Yeah, to be clear, you're not violating any state law when it comes to personnel issues by having a bullet point on an agenda to announce that this is what we're talking about.
No, but what she's doing is she's interpreting the question as, oh, you're talking about, you know, what he's being compensated and how we came to that conclusion. This is why people love political speak so much.
Well, and this is the last day of Sunshine Week, so it's important to point out that this is how government operates on a regular basis, unfortunately.
Well, I was going to get to that when we talked about CMPD and
I set you up, Mike.
Reluctance to
– You are my sunshine.
Well, that video surfaced recently of what could be construed as abusive tactics by a CMPD officer, and Chief Kirkputney has defended that use of force, saying no laws were violated but that an investigation is ongoing. How unusual is it for a comment like that to surface prior to the completion of an investigation? No laws were violated. How do we know that?
Well, we saw from the Carrick case last year that these things often can be unfolding, you know, behind the scenes, and sometimes what's said at early on later turns out that we may have spoken too soon. So I think he may want to, you know, mind his words a little more carefully.
Because a bystander cell phone video of the incident has already surfaced, and it shows seven CMPD officers surrounding a man on the ground with one officer striking him repeatedly with his fist. I haven't seen the video. That's what it was described as. So why withhold the additional body cam footage?
I've seen the video, and the video itself looks bad. But it's very important to note that what you don't see there is actually what the suspect, the man on the ground, is doing.
Okay.
What you can only see.
And there'd been a long chase through the county.
And he was involved in a hit and run. And I mean, there's a lot of things. But the key thing here, and this is, I did a series on body cameras last year when Charlotte was just about to start ramping them out to everybody. And this is one of the trickier things about it. It has this wonderful promise, this idea that now everything is going to be documented. It's not just bystander cell phones, but you see it from police point of view. And I went up to Greensboro, where they've actually had this for a while, and had them walk me through the system. And I went out with an officer. And the first thing you find out is body cameras do change interactions between police and the public, and that is good for a number of reasons. But because of North Carolina state law, it gets back to personnel.
Personnel.
But actually, no. That's what CMPD says, right, is it's a personnel record.
It's personnel or if it's involved in an ongoing potential case.
I don't buy either of those two things because in the general statutes, 132-1.4, which governs police records.
Do that again.
he just made those numbers up. Don't worry about it.
Actually, 132-1.4C3 requires that the circumstances, this is quoting the statute, the circumstances surrounding an arrest be made public. And police departments have interpreted that to say, I'm going to give you this one-page form. However, the statute says the circumstances surrounding an arrest, specifically if there was a chase, if there was resistance. And these are all things that are documented on body cam video. Mm-hmm. Everything that you just talked about, we don't know what the suspect did. And so police departments should be making this public, in my opinion.
And here's the thing. I actually know the statute of which you speak.
Oh, wow. I'll see you, Rain Man, it. Yeah, sorry, Rain Man was an Oscar-winning movie in the late 1980s. All
but right. Nick's too young to remember.
Yeah, that's right. Chris Farley last week, Rain Man this week. Go ahead.
But going back to the statute, I think Nick's interpretation of the law would actually serve CMPD and every other police force in North Carolina if they followed that version of the interpretation. The problem is the precedent that's been set so far. It's the same reason that you don't have the right you do actually in Charlotte, but in North Carolina overall, you actually don't necessarily have the right to see the dash cam footage of your car by precedent. And the trick with that the trick with that is we're at a point now where police departments and the state overall must start to decide what is better, transparency, Nick's interpretation, or the need to keep potential evidence, which is what they also cite.
Yeah.
And that's the precedent they've been following so far. Yeah.
And the prosecutors come in there too, because they will often almost trump the police, even if police want to. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they will consult the prosecutors, because the prosecutors ultimately have to try that case, and the prosecutors always err on the side of no.
But when these body cameras were approved and when we decided to spend all this
money, that was the whole point.
Yeah. Right. CMPD officers were told by city officials that their use would improve transparency correct. And accountability.
Yes, that's
Chief Putney says, he blames it on the personnel laws again. He says the personnel laws haven't changed just because we spent several million dollars on body cameras. So why did we spend the money?
Well, not only that, remember, and you may have been at this meeting too, Tom, when the chief was in front of council, made the very case that you just outlined, Mike, not the one about the personnel laws, but about how the transparency and the relationship between officers, and we would be able to tell exactly what was going on.
And there's another loophole, which, again, would actually go to Nick's argument here, which is already in North Carolina, the police have the ability to release footage regardless of personnel issues, regardless of investigative issues, if it's been deemed to be in the public's good.
True.
That's how you can get footage of, say, a suspect running away from an officer off of a dash cam.
But the problem is they usually won't anyway, because the prosecutors always squash it. Because they say we can't win this case if it gets aired and tried and litigated in the public. There does need to be some sort of a meeting of the minds on this statewide. And maybe this needs to become some sort of case that works its way up to the state Supreme Court.
How important is it that we see it versus it being used in a trial, either by the defense or the prosecution?
I'm biased, but I'd say very important.
Yeah.
I think for the public, for public's trust and confidence.
Particularly in this environment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it only helps them. And there's another interesting point to all of this, is that the Fayetteville Police Chief, Harold Medlock, who spent a long time in Charlotte, this week at Sunshine Week went and told a group of journalists that he supports releasing body camera video at all times, all the time. And so there is some movement that's underfoot a little bit by police to convince other police law enforcement agencies that we need to make this video public, because it does all these things. We can answer so many questions by releasing this video.
So two questions. If we're not going to release videos on a regular basis like this, why did we spend the money on the body cams? And the second question is, if it's a personnel law problem, is there a move afoot? Change the law.
Well, the law actually is very – in North Carolina, the personnel law actually gives a lot of access to a lot of different personnel information, especially if they're being disciplined, if you're being promoted, those records are actually already open. And so I don't think it's a strong argument to rely on that either.
Greensboro PD and the ACLU are actually and have been for some time working together to try to come up with a clarity piece of legislation on this issue. So there's both that's actually going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Yesterday, former Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon was back in town and back in court. Was it yesterday or Wednesday? It was Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Where he pled guilty of voting illegally in the November 2014 election. He had lost his right to vote because at the time he had already been convicted of accepting bribes. He'd been sentenced when he voted, and he said he did so because he just was out to lunch that day. His brain
light
was
didn't
gone
come out. On, he said.
The light didn't come on. Normally, voter fraud is a felony, but this was reduced to a misdemeanor, and the sentence was one extra month in jail, which was also reduced to
one day,
which was reduced to time served. Why the leniency?
Well, you could also ask the other question, you know, kind of why, and I think this is the question that his defense lawyer asks, why even really bother with this when there's
why
this
did it take
giant
two, why did
hammer
it take
already
years?
Hanging over his yes. head?
Why did it take 2 years to bring this to trial?
That's just the docket.
Yeah,
works. Yeah, they noticed it right away.
I think Eric's asking the right question, which is, given what had already happened and where he is now, in a sense, why are you even messing with it?
I mean, they drove him 500 miles for a 10-minute hearing. That's on the taxpayer's dime. I mean, What exactly was gained? I'm not sure.
His family wasn't.
He was in jail. He'll still be in jail.
His family
regardless of what happened.
Family wasn't in the courtroom. What are we to make of that?
I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's anything huge symbolically, but I just thought that was a little bit It was a little odd to me. I don't know.
I suspect he just wanted to spare them the, you know.
So he was sentenced in October of 2014 to 44 months in prison. But even in spite of this latest guilty plea, he should be out by January, released to home detention or a halfway house again because of his former position. Is he receiving special treatment, or is this kind of the norm?
No, this is, if you look at sentencing guidelines, I mean, this is pretty by the book.
Yeah, I have to say, this whole thing, any idea that there's some kind of special treatment out there for somebody who was mayor for not all that long.
4 months.
4 months in a city with a weak mayor system. Yeah. He didn't have the greatest political connection. This is all very straight up.
And in the federal judicial system, there is no special treatment for anybody, you know, when it comes to sentencing and prison time.
Although the legislature is considering overturning Charlotte's LGBTQ ordinance this coming April, city attorney Bob Hageman says he hasn't heard of any firms who say they cannot comply, and he's been trying to debunk, his words, any misunderstandings about what the bathroom provision says. So what has he been saying?
What he is saying is that this is really an issue of accommodation, but not one that requires any changes in terms of signs or bathrooms.
You don't have to change the bathrooms. Men's rooms, women's rooms.
Right. And also that, critics have said that people can just walk in the restroom and expose themselves and things like that. And he says that, you know, all the usual laws, decency laws, still apply. So this is not the radical change that opponents say it will be. We should mention, Mike, that at noon today, the North Carolina Values Coalition will be having a rally to call for a special session in the legislature to try and undo this ordinance.
Because this ordinance goes into effect, April
1st?
So they want to have the special session before the April session begins?
Yes.
It begins at the end of April.
Yeah, April 25th is when the short session begins. They want a special session before that to overturn this.
What's their chance of having that happen, do you think?
I don't think
that. The House has already said yes, but Senate seems to be dragging its feet.
Yeah, and I don't think the Senate wants to. And remember, every day that they're in session is $42,000 more.
See, I think, especially in an election year, I don't know that you can make that one fly.
Yeah. Okay. You're good with numbers, aren't you?
103.2 subsection 4 says that we've got to go.
We do have to go. I can hear the music. That's cut number 47 in the 47B in the world insert there. Tom Bullock, reporter from WFAE News. Nick Oxner, investigative reporter with WBTV News. Eric Frazier, editorial writer with the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Always a pleasure.